This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Well, this week has been unusually tricky. Since the lockdown, the prevailing narrative in the previous 7 days was relatively easy to identify and explore. But this week, not so much. The tension hasn't abated, but it's become amorphous, infused with the prospect or maybe the hope of change for the better. Anyway, it seemed an apt time to look into the past and ahead into the middle distance. We are awash in waves right now, ranging from the viral to the political. So let's start with the viral, where after months of experience, clarity is still hard to find.
Nobody really knows. Is there a second wave? Is there not a second wave?
How will a second wave manifest itself? How will we know that one is upon us?
The fear of a second coronavirus wave is now a reality.
This week, Vice President Pence wrote an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal that ran with the headline, "There isn't a coronavirus, quote, second wave." The piece claims that the media is fueling unwarranted panic, that unwavering progress has been made, that the spread of the virus has been slowed. The headline alone is technically accurate. There is no second wave, because we are, in fact, still in the first wave. But as Johns Hopkins epidemiologist Caitlin Rivers observed this week, it's less like a wave and more like a mesa.
Yeah, that's right. We're really in a plateau. At the national level, we've been recording about 20,000 cases per day for the last more than a month. But some places that were hit very early and hard in the outbreak, like New York and New Jersey, are doing quite well, and they have really successfully turned the corner. But other places never turned the corner, or they had a period of relative quiet and are now experiencing more intense transmission.
Can you give us a snapshot of the states we should be concerned about?
Arizona, Florida, South Carolina, Arkansas, and there are a few others that are also intensifying.
Texas, even Oklahoma.
Oregon. I think it's actually on the order of 15 to 20 states that may be headed in the wrong direction.
Here's a simple question. What is a wave?
There's quite a bad outbreak, and then it ends, and there's a period of quiet, and then a second wave begins. That's not really what we're seeing here. At the national level, we never exited the first wave. There are a few states that I think we could say that they're in a second wave, and those are states that have very low counts overall. Alaska, Hawaii, Montana all really did exit the first wave and had a period of quiet and are now experiencing a resurgence. But those states with high case counts and intense outbreaks, I wouldn't say they ever really left the first wave.
I was thinking of a piece by Ed Young in The Atlantic last month. He referred to the American pandemic as a patchwork pandemic. He said each state's pattern is distinct. Hawaii's looks like a child's drawing of a mountain. Minnesota's looks like the tip of a hockey stick. Maine's looks like a two-humped camel. So not only are different states having different experiences, but cities and rural areas are on different timescales. And American mortality rates obviously differ hugely with respect to race. This splintering, wrote Young, can be psychologically perilous, because it's harder to get a grip on what's actually happening.
I think it is hard. A community could look different than the state numbers, could look different from the national numbers. And that's because diseases are spread through contact networks. How the disease spreads through those networks will vary from place to place and from community to community.
I'm speaking to you from Brooklyn, New York. This state is now undergoing phases of, quote, reopening, a word that suggests we're going back to normal. But What public health experts keep saying is that we're moving forward to a new way of managing in a world with coronavirus. In March, there was a Medium post by Tomas Pueyo entitled The Hammer and the Dance, and it went viral. He saw the hammer as harsh steps like lockdowns when aggressive measures are needed. And the dance represented the careful choreography that we have to perform when things start to ease up. I guess we're in the dance portion?
I do think we're in the dance portion, and I'm not seeing a lot of appetite right now for the hammer. We need to leave that as an option to ensure that we are able to prevent the healthcare systems from becoming overwhelmed. But I would be surprised if we go back to large-scale lockdowns. Part of it is political appetite, and I think it stems from very real concerns about the consequences of lockdowns, if you will, on the economy and what that means for people's lives and livelihoods. But it's also that we've learned more about the virus as we've gone through.
Tell me what we've learned. I raise this partly because there's been some interesting preliminary data from the demonstrations, the protests, and it really seems that if you wore a mask, there wasn't likely to be an uptick in transmissions, at least not so far.
I think it's a little bit early to evaluate whether the protests will have any impact on our epidemiology. It takes about 3 weeks from infection until ICU admission, and I use ICU admission because that's one of the most reliable indicators. That's easy to observe. Things are looking good so far, and I certainly hope that continues to be the case. But you hit on two major points that I think have been major developments in our understanding of transmission, and that's that outdoors is safer than indoors, and also the importance of masks. And universal masking is really a new way of thinking about disease control for us in the United States. It'll be interesting to see whether that is an intervention that we carry forward with us. Early in the outbreak, many states chose to close their outdoor recreation areas, for example. I would be surprised if we go back to making that a restriction, because I do think that those kinds of activities outdoors are relatively safe.
Psychologically, do you think it would have served the public better to suggest that we would always be confronting this disease like a chronic condition? Do you think we would have been less impatient if we understood that this was a national change?
Perhaps. It was always my expectation that this would be a virus that we would have to manage until we had an effective vaccine. Less clear to me and probably to others is whether the United States would be able to gain tight control through case-based interventions, diagnostic testing, and the contact tracing and the isolation. The suite of interventions that South Korea and Singapore, Iceland, Taiwan, New Zealand, Australia have used to control their outbreaks, and they are in a better place than we are. Now, the U.S. has scaled up on all of those interventions quite a lot. It's just that we never transitioned to fully managing our outbreaks in this way. And so I think making clear now that without that kind of approach, we will have to be more careful than some other countries is helpful for helping the public to understand that this will be a longer-term event.
You testified to a House committee last month about the government's response. You also raised a concern about complacency in that hearing.
It's still with us. We've been averaging 500 to 700 new deaths each day for the last few weeks. And that's really extraordinary. That's a huge loss of life that is largely preventable. And if we relax on that, we could experience exponential growth again. The conditions of March are still a possible future scenario, and we need to continue to be vigilant. One development I've been excited about in our national conversations is a recent brief that CDC gave about how people can think about the risks of different activities. Can I go to a barbecue? Can I meet my family member's new baby? And I love that we're spending more time helping people to understand how to evaluate the risks of those activities for themselves. The kinds of national conversations I'm not as excited about are trying to move ahead of the pandemic and trying to put it behind us.
On Twitter this week, you observed, "This pandemic is one of the most intense, broadly shared experiences in history. That's the real story. The schisms are a distraction."
I see a lot in the headlines of yes masks, no masks, can we open bars, should we not open bars? And those are all legitimate discussions. But I don't want people to miss that we are going through something very intense and that we are all sharing that experience. Now, we are not sharing it in the same way. There are communities that have been harder hit than others. There have been communities of color in particular that have experienced disproportionate impacts. But at the 30,000-foot level, we are all living through history and we are going through it together. And that is a lens that I would like to see more of in our national conversations.
Caitlin, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Caitlin Rivers is an epidemiologist and professor at Johns Hopkins University.
Coming up, waves are the signature motion of our times, our health, our politics. But do they signal another kind of stasis or a sea change?
This is On the Media.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.